Stand by. Transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
How you doing? And welcome to the show. And this week we are very excited to have our relationship coach, Frank Kermit, join us to talk about May-December romance. He's got great advice about if this is something that would work for you, because it does push against social norms. Author and management consultant Leland Hazelwood also stops by to talk about eco-friendly products and if they are really as green as we think they are. He'll also talk about what some companies are doing to become more environmentally friendly. We've got lots to do. Let's go.
Capture your need for sound.
Romantic relationships are a wonderful thing, but when you step outside the norm, it seems that a lot of people want to weigh in and judge you. A good example of this is a May-December romance. Many people question it because it's seen as being way out in left field and prone to failure. To help us understand the ins and outs of a May-December romance is relationship coach Frank B. Kermit. Frank, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks, Kelly. Great to be here.
Frank, I guess in general terms, can you sort of explain what a May-December romance is, because generally involves, because I think some people may be a little bit confused.
Okay, the term May-December relationship refers to a couple where one person is much, much older than the other. And usually you're talking a minimum 20-year age gap. They refer to May-December relationship because they figure that the younger person is represented by May. They're in their prime of their life, in the middle of their life. And the other person is December, meaning they're at the near the end of their life and they're in the winter of their life.
Why does society, I guess, treat, you know, May-December romances like a big scandalous situation?
The biggest challenge with May-December relationships is how friends and family around that couple will react to them. And it's everything from just disapproval to, you know, some people consider the May-December relationship a threat to their own relationships. They will accuse people in May-December relationships of, like, taking advantage of one another. And sometimes it's just seen as a sign of emotional dysfunction that requires therapy. So let's start off with disapproval. Some people have ideas about what a relationship should be, meaning that they will conduct themselves in a certain way in their own relationships, and they put that expectation on everyone else. One of those expectations could be the couple should be about the same age so they can grow old together. When you're dealing with a May-December relationship, there's an obvious point that, statistically speaking, the older person in the couple will die before, way before, the younger person in the couple. And this, for some people, is an issue, because it's one of those things you can see from the outside of the relationship. The fact is, though, when you're dealing with a couple that's the same age, there may be a chronic illness there, or a life-threatening illness, or somebody just has a low life expectancy rate because of an illness that they have, but it's not as present to the public as a May-December relationship is.
Frank, I guess that's something that sort of popped up into my mind when you were speaking. I don't even want to say this, but it's just, I have to put it out there. Is it more difficult if the woman is older than, you know, her partner?
Well, this depends really on the partner, but we have certain prejudices there. In a case where we're dealing, let's say, with an older man and he's dating a younger woman, there's still the possibility for them to have kids on their own. When you're dealing with an older woman who, let's say, is postmenopausal, she's not in a position to have children naturally. So the big issue is, for some people, is, well, if your relationship can't produce children, then it's not a real relationship. You know, you're just having a sexual fling and there's no emotional commitment involved. So there's always going to be some sort of stigma. I mean, there are some people who feel that way about alternative forms of relationships. At one point, the reason that people said, well, you know, gay marriage shouldn't happen. Well, there's no way that a marriage like that could produce children, so why be married? Because people have a very, very narrow view of what a relationship can be. So when you're dealing with prejudice, it's hard to deal with the fact that some people just are not reasonable because they're clouded by their own hatred.
Can we talk more about the prejudices, I guess, that a May-December romance, you know, will face? Because it just seems like, you know, there's so many factors outside of the relationship that you're going to have to deal with like, you know, growing children being very upset that their father or mother is involved with what might be seen as like some opportune young thing.
Well, some of the prejudices within even, let's say, the social circles, some people view the May-December relationship as a threat. Now, this could be the children of one of the people in the couple, because they say, well, who is this person who's stepping in here who's trying to manipulate my parent into a relationship? That's going to cost me my inheritance. So one of the things I advise anybody getting into a May-December relationship, make sure that if you have children, make sure that you really are clear in your will about what's going to happen to your estate. Because depending where you live, the law might step in and divide up your estate between your partner and your kids in ways that you did not anticipate. So, I mean, I happen to know one story of a May-December relationship where the couple had been together for a number of years, but they never actually got married. And when one of the partners died, the older one, that person's kid came by and just took everything, saying, well, that was my parent, and I have a legal right to it. And the partner was saying, now, wait a minute, we've been together for many, many years, and, you know, your parent would want me to have at least some of this stuff so I could, you know, be taken care of. And the kid said, nope, too bad, you know, and just wiped everything out, including all the bank accounts. So these are very real issues that the romance is great, but you have to make sure that you understand the legal implications when it comes to the division of property. In terms of a social environment as to why May-December relationships can be seen as a threat, some people will, well, let's say they're in a couple and they're about the same age, and one of their friends is now dating someone who's either much, much older or much, much younger. They might say, you know, my relationship may not be too steady. My partner is the same age as me. My partner might want to date somebody who's much older or much younger. I don't want them leaving me to say, oh, look, now it's possible. So when you're tapping onto people's insecurities and you're tapping onto people's fear of abandonment, it could really turn them against the May-December relationship couple, because you're setting a precedent. You're showing what's possible. This is wrong.
Okay.
It could just be a matter of jealousy, too. Some people are just very jealous because they would like to do it. You could be dealing with a young person who would love to date an older partner, but because of the social stigmas, doesn't have the guts to do it. And when they see somebody else doing it and toughing out the social stigma, they might just get jealous and take part in that. Well, that's wrong. What they really mean is, that's wrong because I'd want to do it too, but I don't have the guts.
Joining us on the show is relationship coach Frank B. Kermit. You can check him out at www.franktalks.com. Frank, you know, as you were talking, it just seems like this May-December couple has to be so strong outside of their relationship, because it just feels like there's so many social stigmas, as you were saying, that it's almost like they need to have this big coat of armor to handle what's coming in from the outside, you know, and we're not even talking yet about what's going on in their own relationship.
If you want to enter a May-December relationship, you're going to have to make sure that your relationship is as independent as possible from needing other people. Because it's very likely you're going to lose a lot of people's support just because you have been public with it. For some reason, our society seems to take the attitude of, well, if it's just a sexual fling, don't bring the person around. And a May-December relationship has no possibility for longevity. Some people find it gross. Some people find it taxing. So if your relationship isn't very strong to begin with, if you're not the type of person who can handle social stigma, it might not be the relationship structure for you. And if you are going to get into that kind of relationship, it has to be strong. You have to know that you can trust your partner. There has to be open lines of communication. And you better be ready to deal with all kinds of stigma from people you may never have even considered would have a problem with it.
How do you keep families at bay, or even friends at bay, from trying to cause trouble in the relationship? Because it just seems like, it almost feels like this being in a May-December romance could be worse than even, you know, trying to be in a gay relationship. Because it just seems like almost a gay relationship would be more acceptable these days than a May-December thing. Because it just seems like that is still taboo.
I think that the best way you can do it is to just set your standards when you're in a relationship about behaviors you will and will not tolerate, and just adhere to those behaviors. So that when someone comes up to you and says, "Listen, what you're doing is wrong," you have to have a prepared response for anyone who wants to step in and tell you what to do with your life, even if that means walking away. For the biggest number of May-December relationships who face this stigma, sometimes the only thing you can do is let everybody know, "Look, this is who I've chosen to be in a relationship with. This is who I love. And I don't have to justify it to anybody. So you're either with me or you're against me."
What are some of the real issues that couples face in this type of relationship as opposed to, what family and friends think is going on? Because there's all, like you said, the social aspect of just being out in the community and people having their two cents. But when you're in it yourself, I guess, what do you need to be aware of?
Okay, the first thing you need to be aware of is that, let's make sure you actually aren't being used. If you're the younger person in the relationship, let's make sure that you're not just being used as some sort of a trophy or as a means for the older partner to relive their youth or not face their mortality. If you're the older person in the couple, let's make sure you're not actually being used. Let's make sure that someone isn't just looking for a free ride for your wealth and resources. Because usually the older person has got the wealth and resources, and the younger person usually has a certain level of attractiveness that makes them, a quote unquote a prize. So that's the first thing. Make sure you're not being used. Make sure that's not the reason you're getting into a relationship. Next, if you do have children going into a May-December relationship, there's additional worries there. If you're the older person in the couple, make sure you have a will that really defines what's going to happen to your estate, regardless or not if you get married to a new partner, and make sure that that will reflects the laws of wherever you're living. Because depending on where you are in the world, your new spouse, if you choose to get married, may have rights over your own children. And in other parts of the world, everything is going to be divided up equally. So make sure that you're aware of the law if you're the younger person in the relationship and you're coming into that relationship with children. Understand that statistically speaking, you're going to end up alone much sooner than most of your peers. So if you're dating someone who's 20 years older than you, that person is going to get sick a lot sooner than all of your friends' spouses. That person is going to die, let's say, 20 years earlier than you, assuming that, you're both would die around the same age. You're going to end up alone. Now, if let's say you're with somebody who's got a lot of wealth and can support you, and you're not in the workforce for that period of time, what's going to happen to you when your partner does die? What's going to happen to your kids if you have kids in this situation? You got to be smart about it. You got to think for the future, and you have to be realistic. So those are some of the real issues that you're dealing with. One more real issue is that sometimes the older person in the couple might take for granted what the younger person should know because the older person just has more life experience. The younger person can sometimes feel left out because, oh, the older person just keeps, downplaying what I know, downplaying my knowledge. This happened to me once I dated a decisively older woman. And every now and then she would just turn to me and think, "Oh, you're just so young. You're just so silly. Don't you know this?" And it comes across as insulting. The same way that the young person sometimes might be so involved with a social life and new technologies, social networks even, that the old person just can't grasp, and that the old person might feel isolated from their partner. So you're going to have to deal with a younger person who's much more mature and possibly much more experienced with life, and you're going to have to deal with an older person who doesn't act their age, to use a cliche. So those are some of the issues that a May-December relationship would face.
And in the grand scheme of things, Frank, why do, I guess, May-December relationships happen? Like, what's the attraction, I guess?
May-December relationships happen for the same reason that any and all relationships happen. Because it's not about what people like, it's about what people respond to. People go into relationships because that particular relationship addresses emotional needs of that person. And when do those relationships end? When the emotional needs are no longer addressed. So you have to look at what it is you value in a relationship. And if a May-December relationship addresses the things that you value, the things that you respond to, the emotional needs that you have, then it's a good relationship for you. If they don't address your emotional needs, then it's a bad relationship. You know, with that said, one of my philosophies and one of the things I teach is that whatever your relationship is based on, when you remove that element, the relationship is likely doomed. If the relationship was based on using somebody for their wealth and resources, or trophyism, where, you know, the older partner wants the younger partner as a trophy, well, once the trophyism loses its power, once the wealth and resources have been depleted, if that's the only thing the relationship was based on, well, the relationship is going to end.
I guess with regards to the younger person in the relationship, I think a lot of people would say, you know, if it's a, you know, a female dating an older man, you know, they have daddy issues. Or if it's a young, you know, a younger man with an older woman, then it's mommy issues. Like, how do you get around that? And how do you yourself know if maybe that might be an issue?
Okay, this is a really big topic. It really comes down to people needing therapy and trying to make up for something they lacked in their childhood in their current relationship. The first thing to understand is even couples who are in the same age group are going to have those type of issues. We all reenact issues from our upbringing into our relationships. So that's just something across the board. If it's not an issue you've dealt with in your childhood or you've consciously made a change, chances are you're going to reenact that in your relationships because as children, we learn attachment, we learn the dynamics of what love is and how we respond to love from our family environments. So we all take it with us into our relationships. When you're dealing with May-December relationships, it could be a sign that the younger person has a parental issue that did not get resolved, or that the older person has got some sort of issue about growing old, and then they're doing everything they can to grasp their youth and their vitality by dating younger people. How do you know? One of the ways that I would look at it is, was there an immediate crisis happening when the relationship first got together? One of the stories I know, there was a couple where I think it was the wife in the couple whose father had just recently died. She left her husband, who was about the same age, to start dating one of her father's older friends because there was a crisis in her life where she had lost her daddy figure and then immediately charged and went ahead for another daddy figure. So it could be those type of issues. But my clientele, I deal with a lot of men who never got love from mommy. So they sometimes will date a much older woman because they're just looking for that mommy love. And this applies to all genders as well and all sexual orientations. Sometimes if somebody did not get what they wanted in their childhood, they may try to get that from their partner. Well, this is a recipe for disaster because it's not the job of your partner to be your parent. It's the job of your partner to be your partner. But if you go into a relationship with unreasonable expectations, the only people you're going to attract are people who are just as emotionally unhealthy. Now, what happens over the course of a relationship when one of you heals? Again, whatever the relationship was based on, if you remove that element, you lose the relationship. If the relationship was based on an unhealthy emotional attachment and one of you heals, the relationship is over. And this is a primary reason why sometimes your partner isn't so happy when you're making positive changes in your life, because it could be a threat to the relationship.
Joining us on the show is relationship coach Frank B. Kermit. Again, check him out at www.franktalks.com. Frank, something that we didn't sort of talk a lot about yet is, I guess, if this couple, this May-December couple, should consider having or adopting children.
I got to tell you, this is a really hard question because I'm very wary of trying to tell anybody what to do with their bodies if they choose to have children or if they choose not to have children. So the general rule for me is if you do have a child, regardless of the relationship structure you're in, will the child be taken care of? Can the child be provided for? And is the child going to feel that the child was wanted? Now, if you can take care of those three things, making sure the child is provided for, making sure that you're in a position to care for the child, and making sure that the child always feels that they're wanted. Then go ahead, if you've got those areas covered. In a May-December relationship, there may be an issue of limited wealth and resources. There could be an issue that the older couple may not be around long enough to raise the child and to be there for the child because their life expectancy at that point is a lot less in comparison to the age range of how long it takes for the child to grow up. So if you are in a position to have kids and make sure those kids are taken care of and supported and loved, then go ahead. And if you're not in that position, don't have children. And this is something I would tell a same-age couple, a young couple even, whether it's adoption, whether it's through natural means or whatnot, fertility clinics. Are you in a position to be a parent, yes or no? And if the answer is, well, not really, we're not ready yet, and so on, then don't have kids. Be responsible. I look at the situation. There was a woman, Maria del Carmo, and she was 66 when she had two twin boys. And her, she used a fertility clinic. And her argument was, well, my mother lived until 101, so I have the same genes, and I'll live just as long, and I'll be there for my kids. Well, when the boys were 2 years old, she died. So she was not even going to be there to take care of these kids. And it's that's a sad thing. But you never know. You really never know. It's just statistically speaking, more people in their 60s and 70s are going to die than people in their 20s and 30s. In their 20s or 30s, you need that, you need that really major disease to hit. You need that horrible accident to happen. But when you're older, it's just a higher possibility that you're not going to be around and anything can happen. So you're taking a chance.
And Frank, I guess, we've been talking a lot about, the difficulties of going through this type of relationship, but obviously there is a lot of positives. I guess just to sort of wrap things up, can you sort of outline, these relationships do work.
Any relationship can work. Any relationship can work because you're looking at the emotional needs of these individuals. However, some relationships are going to face more stigma and more opposition than other relationships. Nobody questions the relationship of the good-looking young couple who are getting together, starting their life together. They may or may not have kids. They even go through the process of getting married. And everybody says, oh, this is great. Oh, this is wonderful. Oh, they're such a wonderful couple. They look so good together. And then everybody's in shock when 5 to 7 years later that couple is getting divorced. But that relationship did not receive any opposition, maybe because they're both very attractive people. They both got good careers. But that alone isn't what's going to make a relationship work. Then you can have other couples who face incredible opposition, where you have family saying, I will no longer associate with you if you go date that other person. And those relationships, because of the hardships that they go through, are actually strengthened. And the couple makes a commitment to say, everybody else is going to be against us. We have to really be on the same page. So you have to remember that any relationship can work. But it's about whether or not the couple involved knows how to manage those relationships. If they're going to be in a monogamous relationship, do they know the rules of monogamy? Do they follow them? If they want to have a non-monogamous relationship, are they going to behave in a way to maintain that relationship and be able to keep it going? So if they're in a relationship structure that's going to get a lot of opposition, are they strong enough to fight that opposition? Are they independent enough that they don't need people's approval to be in their relationship? Those are the elements that have to be looked at. I would never look at a couple and say, well, one is older, one is younger, it's just not going to work long term. They have the possibility to have a great relationship just like anybody else if they understand the principles of relationship management.
And then in the end as well, they need to make sure that they're very solid because they are going to face a lot of adversity from their family and friends.
100%.
Okay.
Anytime you get into a relationship that is going to face any opposition, you have to be a really strong person to make it work. And that's actually one of the biggest really reasons why a lot of these relationships never materialize. Because people know that they don't have the strength and they don't have the guts to put up with all the opposition that's going to come with being in that kind of relationship.
Frank, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
This was really great, Tilly. Hope to do it again.
That's Frank B. Kermit again, our relationship coach. And again, more information, www.franktalks.com.
Capture your need for sound.
From his debut album in 1999 called Black on Both Sides, this is Most Def and an amazing instrumental song called May December on The Kelly Alexander Show. Going green these days is definitely in style. It makes you look like a concerned citizen, and most likely you actually really do care about the environment. But just because a product says that it's eco-friendly doesn't necessarily mean that it is. To help us be more aware as green consumers is management consultant and author of two editions of the Green Toys Directory, Leland Hazelwood. Leland, thank you for joining us on The Kelly Alexander Show.
My pleasure to be on this show. Thank you very much, Kelly.
Leland, you know, in this day and age, how can a package or product be labeled as green, but then not really measure up? How do these companies get away with, I guess, half-truths?
Well, there are many reasons why this happens. One, customers are not fully informed of what it means to be green and how to evaluate the green product. Also, customers have different standards of what might be green. So there's a certain amount of confusion there. In terms of setting standards, green is relatively new. So the standards from the government level I mean, from your own Canadian Competition Bureau and the FTC in the United States, they just used the general marketing standards, and they're now beginning to come to grips with the details of green. So there is a lot of room for loose interpretation, and so there's a wide area of confusion.
Okay.
I think these are the basic causes of it.
And so, Leland, what does what makes a product truly green?
Well, if it's there are certain standards that people look at. Is it biodegradable? Is it recyclable? Are the materials reusable? These are the types of things that people look at. You look also at the production process, how the product was made, the types of raw materials that have been used, the type of packaging. Are these things, does this process reflect a sensitivity towards the use of natural resources? These are some of the general guidelines. Now, no product is, very few products is claimed to be 100% green or such, because you have to look at the production process, which may include some fossil fuels or things like that, the transportation to get it to the store, the retail store, and what have you. Maybe in the type of vehicle, that's fossil fuel and so on. So, excuse me. So there are degrees of greenness, but what one has to look and make one's own judgment is that, is there a reasonable attempt on the company to make, to substantiate the claim it's making to a green product, or does it meet my personal standard as to what I think a green product ought to be in terms of its content, the process which it has been produced and presented to the consumer.
Okay, and Leland, I actually just wanted to thank you for sort of explaining that, because I think a lot of us as consumers, you know, we're in the store and we're running around and we're just trying to get things done. And then if we see something that says green on it or eco-friendly, you know, we feel good about ourselves if we purchase it. But I think a lot of us don't think about the ramifications, like you mentioned earlier, where, you know, was it a green process to actually even get that product to the store? So I think it's great to actually think about the back end of these products, not just the products themselves. And I guess, you know, as a consumer, how can we sort of be proactive and really know what products we are actually purchasing?
Right. Well, I think you need to look at labels as well as to educate yourself as to the types of things I just mentioned before. As to what are the types of things to look for being green. Now, let me give you some of the negatives first, you know, the greenwashing, because that's really the problem. Where, because of the confusion that I've explained to you before, there is a wide room for misleading information and misleading consumers. You know, you may see and companies being advertised or promoted as environmentally friendly, eco-safe, harnessing nature, green, or they may be green imagery, you know, fresh water leaves and the color green and whatever on their labels. You know, but these are really very vague things, but for the consumer who wants to do the right thing, who wants to change their habits, you know, they're recycling and they're just trying to do a number of things to become green and eco-sensitive. These types of misleading words, misleading graphics and visuals and vague claims and sometimes overstating the claims, you know, or leaving out this very important information that would give you a clearer description of how the product is constituted, you know, or putting irrelevant information And sometimes outright fibbing. These are the types of things that confuse well-intentioned consumers who really want to do the right thing, but they're not quite sure how to evaluate this type of terminology that's presented to them on labels and advertising by products.
And Leland, can you give us some ideas, I guess, about some maybe major product brands and how they actually stack up as being truly green? Because I think, you know, there's always this talk of brand loyalty. And I think some of us blindly follow that, especially, you know, if your mom used Tide as a kid, you know, for your washing material, and you've just sort of followed along. Do you know how some of these major brands are actually stacking up?
Yes, there's some boutique, you know, smaller brands that I think are really doing a very good job in promoting their product, genuinely good products. There's the Myers Clean Bay brand. They have a series of cleaning products for, you know, dishwashing and hands and things like that. That's one thing that comes to the top of my head. It's basically really looking at the labels and trying out. I could tell you some, let me give you an example of a few things that they're really, really off and misleading from very reputable companies. You know, you may have a power company, very good power company. They have a good social response, corporate social responsibility record, you know, but they're providing their power to the public from fossil fuel. Okay? Now, we don't expect these companies to change overnight. These are things that the government is working on, public policy and how we get into renewable energy and so on. But what is misleading is you will have a green ad, a page of the, it's all green. You could afford to buy an entire page in a newspaper. And they talk about all of the corporate social responsibility things that they're doing, which could be very extensive and good. And then they may give you how to save power. They may give you rebates, you know, and if you use your air conditioning in a certain way. And number of tips, energy saving tips and what have you. And then they'll tell you that we have on our grid, you know, wind power, wind farms, you know, renewable energy. Now, these wind farms and wind power are probably 0.5%. Or maybe 1 or 2%, if that much, of the total output of a company. You know, it's a start in the right direction, but it's an overstatement of the greenness of this company. All right? Or you may have a hotel, who will talk about their efforts to go green because they're asking you to use the sheet another evening. The sheets or the towels, extended use of the towels in order to save water in washing and so on, that's just a red herring because they're not addressing the issue of how they use water and power and whatever in other ways. You may have also a reputable company that has nicely packaged you know, aluminum foil, right? And on the cover, the packaging says recyclable. Now, you have to read carefully to understand that they're talking about the packaging that's recyclable, not the aluminum foil inside the packaging. Yeah. So that sometimes reputable companies get away with things like these, and customers who don't take the time to analyze what's being said sometimes feel good that they're doing the right thing when in fact they're not.
Okay. Joining us on the show is Leland Hazelwood, a management consultant and author of two editions of the Green Toys Directory, greentoysguide.com, also of the children's book, Chester Goes to Africa, which has an environmental theme. Leland, can you explain, I guess, the truth about hybrid cars and biodiesel engines, and maybe like what's the difference and which one is actually better, if in fact one is better than the other?
Well, you know, I went to the auto show I guess 2 months ago, you know, and I think I was really very impressed. Let me say this. I think finally the auto companies are really making an attempt to address the issue in turning out green products. You know, for instance, like the Leaf, I think that's a Nissan. That's a totally electric car. You know, the Miev, that's another Japanese brand, totally electric. Then I went into General Motors and Ford, you know, like the Volt and Focus, which is a hybrid car. I rent cars, and when I rent cars, I ask specifically for hybrid cars, which are now available. And these, they put less greenhouse gases out there, less carbon monoxide out into the air, because the hybrid car, which is a combination of still the fossil fuel, you know, petrol or gas, when you pause, let's say at a stoplight or so, it switches to electricity, which means the exhaust stops. And that is a major contribution. The exhaust, particularly when cars stop in driving in the city, it's a major cause of pollutants and greenhouse gases and so on. So that's really an improvement. And then you have Ford calls it EcoBoost engine. I think GM calls it EcoAssist, which is their version of the hybrid car, where you could switch from electricity to the use of gasoline at specific times. And they're getting reasonably good mileage. I think the way to look at that is the direction in which the cars are moving. I think that's the way we need to evaluate the automobile in industry. Of course, you know, there's the use of ethanol and, as you say, biodiesel, which has not really been adopted extensively as yet in North America. Now, you go to Brazil, And the cars there, really very impressed by that. You make your choice whether you want to drive on ethanol or drive on regular gasoline. And there's a button on the dashboard where you could make that switch at any time without changing the performance of the car. You could drive totally on ethanol, or you could drive totally on gasoline or any mixture that you want. You know, that is real progress, but we have not done that. We have not gone there as yet. And I think a step forward also might be when you have these hybrid cars, a combination of gasoline and electricity, maybe the next step might be the combination of electricity and something like ethanol or biodiesel or something like that. But I asked the people at the show, and they said no, they're not there as yet because of reliable supplies and so on of the biodiesel. But the bottom line is people have to ask for it. These cars are performing reasonably well, but people have to ask for it to drive the manufacturers in that direction.
Okay. And something that I wanted to touch upon, because I think it's a very important aspect of this, but I think a lot of us don't think about it, is actually children's toys, because, you know, there's so much plastic out there and packaging, and it just seems like there's a lot of waste when it comes to children's toys. Are there ones, you know, toys that parents should be on the lookout for that are actually, you know, green or eco-friendly?
That are eco-friendly? Well, you know, the best category of toys that are eco-friendly are toys made from wood. Because you know the type of wood. Is this a sustainable forestry? Is this a wood that's being threatened in a North American or a South American rainforest or whatever? That's an easy determination to make. And those are the safest group of products. Most toys, many toys are made of some form of plastic. And in that particular industry, there's a large overstatement of claims for BPA-free and phthalates, which is misleading and could be harmful to young kids. Also, in plush toys, where there are claims of natural materials, organic cotton, and whatever. No bleaches, no chemical softeners in the production of the processes and so on. Sometimes these claims are overstated, and the toy industry have significant violations in this area. And this is one of the reasons why I prepared the Green Toys Directory, because it helps parents, it helps mothers, in evaluating choices, and know that there are some companies that are making green claims for their toys, but there's still more evaluation that has to be made in this area.
And Leland, are there any protection agencies that are out there that are monitoring companies, you know, to make sure they are following, I guess, quote unquote, green guidelines?
Well, in Canada, I think there are guidelines by the Canadian Competition Bureau. In the United States, the FTC, there's a particular section that starts to address that issue, which would give you definitions as well as regulations in some instances. Now, there's ISO 1420 series, I think it's the 1421 series, that attempts to address green standards, and this is international. These are broad areas, but there are specific private organizations. You know, for instance, there's Green America. They have their definition as to what they consider green companies. Sometimes the fair trade certification is an indication of a degree of greenness, even though it's more about making sure that the products that you import from overseas, particularly from the developing world, were produced without exploitation of labor and good business practices and what have you. Then they're like Tree Hugger, they have the Best of the Green Awards. Then there's LEED Certified for Housing by the U.S. GBC that sets standards for materials and ways in which you construct housing that will be considered green. There's Green Seal Organization. There's a Sustainable Forest Initiative label, which would give you an indication of the forestry materials. So there are a number of organizations that are emerging, that are credible organizations, and each specializing in a different area, whether it's a product, materials area, and what have you. I think in Canada there are a number of other organizations, I think there's a group called the CFPA, there's the CRI Green Label, there's the EcoCert, there's the Eco Logo, which is an international standards of which there is a group in Canada. There's the Energy Star, and So there are organizations, but you have to see what their standards are and what they're evaluating. And this also adds to the confusion because there's so many different organizations emerging. But that's the nature of our free enterprise society.
And Leland, obviously this is a topic that's very close to your heart. And so I have to ask you, in the grand scheme of things, do you think that we are actually becoming more green or eco-friendly, or is that just, I guess, like a nice term to make people feel better about the state of the planet?
No, I think we are. I think we definitely are. But what I've been addressing today is the abuse of the term and exploiting the confusion. But in general, I think we are. And one of the reasons why the exploitation takes place is because companies recognize that consumers are looking for green products because they feel this is a way in which they could contribute to the sustainability of the environment, you know, that translates all back to, you know, global warming and climate change and that type of thing. So that companies are attempting to respond, and companies are doing this by genuine technological innovations. But some companies are under pressure or for whatever reason that feel the need to meet this customer demand or pressure by the consumer under the need to promote their products to satisfy the consumer need for green products and the confusion in the environment, in this whole area of business. This is where the greenwashing comes in, with vague and misleading labeling and whatever. But that also is a reflection that we're moving in the right direction. But these are the abuses that we need to correct.
And Leland, I just find all of this so educational and fascinating. And where can people actually get copies of your books?
Well, the Green Toys directory, they could get it immediately. It's downloadable. That's downloadable at www.greentoysguide.com. The Chester Goes to Africa, it's a nice book that could be gotten for kids and for parents to read to kids from Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com. That's the easiest way to get access to the book.
Fantastic. Leland, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to have a discussion because I'm really passionately interested in this area. And this is one of my ways of trying to make a contribution.
Excellent. Thank you so much. That is Leland Hazelwood, again, a management consultant and author of 2 editions of the Green Toys Directory. Again, greentoysguide.com. And again, Chester Goes to Africa, right here on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Bring on the Remix.
Tell me why.
There you go. Another edition of the Kelly Alexander Show has come to an end. And a big shout out going out to my guests, Frank Kermit, as well as Leland Hazelwood. And as per usual, if you have any comments or questions, kelly@kellyalexandershow.com. And I want to leave you with a positive quote of the week from Vernon Howard. A truly strong person does not need the approval of others any more than a lion needs the approval of sheep. There you go. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.